You're listening to the Ask Drone You podcast. You ask, we answer your drone questions. Whether you're here to turn your passion into profit or you simply fly for fun, we're a community of learners and teachers who aspire to achieve greatness. We are
Drone You.
Hey everyone, welcome to another awesome episode of Ask Drone You. My name is Paul and I have the pleasure of having Keenan Newton from Saving Lives with Drones, right? Is it, or Save Lives with Drones?
Nope, Saving Lives with Drones, you got it right, Paul.
Awesome, awesome. Well, Keenan has been an advocate in our community for so long, and I've personally flown with Keenan, and he's one of the first people I know who got his 107 license. And frankly, he's doing so much for search and rescue. He's doing so much for ensuring the drones are doing good things instead of bad things. And that's why I wanted to bring him on the show. Now, you've heard me talk about the drone you fly in and the conference. Keenan is going to be a very integral part to that. So, Keenan, welcome to the show, my friend.
Thank you very much, Paul. I'm really happy to be on.
Awesome. I'm really happy to talk to you because I know recently you went to a public safety conference. And for those who aren't familiar, public safety is police, it's fire, it's else am I missing? Hazmat.
Emergency management. It can even go out to civil agencies like the Red Cross and whatnot. So it's a large group of people, and you have a different federal, state, local level. So, but pretty much emergency management, fire, police, those are the three core components.
The three main ones, yeah. And the thing is at this recent conference, you actually did or gave a panel or a speech, I forget exactly what it was, concerning pre-planning data in search and rescue. Is that correct?
Right. So what it is, I chaired the fire service panel, and it was myself, Chief Chris Sadler from the York County, which is in Virginia, from fire department. He's a fire chief there, and the one and only John McBride. He was the other panel member, and they focused on their specific bits where York County talked about how they configured their Matrice 600 and how their program is working. John obviously talked a lot about thermography and what it can and can't do, and kind of dispelled some of the myths. And I focused on mapping. And the kind of the key value, it's not necessarily the sexiest when you think of search and rescue, but it's pre-planning and mapping and kind of having that situational awareness and kind of having an attack plan for whatever type of situation you're in, whether it's dealing with a wildland fire or an active shooter situation. It's critical, and having that information for incident command is a big deal.
So tell us a little bit about the mapping procedures that you're doing. And, having this reconnaissance is obviously really important. So where does mapping add that extra level of detail? And how are the fire services like you using this technology to get a better gauge on the problem at hand? I know situational awareness is huge, but how does mapping take us to that next level?
Okay, so there's two main things that can happen with mapping. Well, really three. First is pre-planning. And pre-planning is basically something very big in the fire service, is when we have a large commercial structure, something that we want to have an idea of how we would attack a situation if the building caught fire or something, an incident happened at that structure, how would we approach it? Where are the doors? Where are the hazards located? And when it comes to mapping and basically 3D modeling, I can actually create that 3D image of that building, see where the doors are, see where maybe they had 20 or 30, 55 gallons drums of diesel fuel, and see where they actually stored it, and be able to have a 3D model that I could spin around. So let's say it got hit by a tornado, and all of a sudden the building no longer looks like the building anymore. Well, I can go refer back to this 3D model and see, underneath this roof that has collapsed, right here under this wall that collapsed, there should be roughly, 2,000 gallons of diesel fuel that's in 55-gallon drum barrels that may be leaking. And, by the way, I created this digital surface model. Now I can see which way that diesel fuel is going to be flowing, so I know where I can dike to prevent that product from making it into the water stream and into the water table itself. So there's a lot of value that pre-planning can offer.
So now in this pre-planning, if I understand this correctly, do you think it's going to come to a point in time where fire services are going to be out mapping the areas that are around their district so that they can have this detailed information?
I think it's going to start on a per structure basis, and it's going to be mostly for larger buildings. It won't be like an entire community, like the residential neighborhoods. Obviously, you don't want to look like Big Brother, and doing that sort of thing would kind of give that appearance, I think. But I think like for commercial buildings, a large industrial complex, let's say like a steel mill or oil refinery, absolutely. And it's one of those things that, you know, when we do pre-planning, you know, we obviously talk with the business owner. So they're very well aware of what it is that we're doing. We're just not just showing up and doing it. But I think, for the more critical infrastructure. Now, if you take like a residential house, the hazards probably are not going to be the same or as severe as it can be in an industrial complex. So that's something to take into account.
Very interesting, very interesting. Now, at this conference for public safety and drones, which was really showcasing the different uses, what stood out to you beyond the panel, beyond using mapping, beyond the normal thermography stuff? What stood out to you as new that would really have an effect for more fire departments like yourself to know about?
I think actually the versatility of the Matrice 600, believe it or not. And the reason why I say that is because I saw the 600 configured, York County actually did this configured with two light bridges. And basically it kind of beat the punch to the Matrice 200 or 210, I should say, with a dual gimbal. Mm-hmm. And they were using two light bridges to actually, and they had two gimbals mounted on it, one with the flight controller and the second one actually just dedicated to the second gimbal. So I thought that was pretty cool. They actually had a drop system on it, where you could actually go ahead and you know, drop, let's say, like a life safety device if someone was drowning in the water or if they were way out in the sticks and it was going to take 3-4 hours or maybe in a day to get rescuers to them. You could get them food, water, emergency blankets, and bring it to them by UAS, maybe in a canyon where you couldn't get a helicopter, for instance. I think what else kind of stood out was just some of the technology-related stuff, because there were talks about how you can utilize, privacy concerns a little bit, or kind of like what DJI has been doing with, or any other manufacturers, or what they have not been doing around securing the signal itself. How can we transmit the video signal and do it in a secure way? And so that way incident command can see it, but prying eyes can't see it. Think about maybe like a, God forbid, like a terrorist action, that sort of thing. I think that was one of the things that was something of topic. I mean, DJI does have some basic level of encryption, don't get me wrong, but, it's not like Department of Defense secure type of thing, right?
Yeah. It's funny. I'm actually doing a show later this week talking about the DJI and the level of security and whether it's ITAR compliant to be able to even collect this information for critical infrastructure. Is it causing a problem with Homeland Security? Is because DJI is a Chinese manufacturer, and whether people realize it or not, the military has an embargo against China for using their products for the military. So if it's critical infrastructure, then you're linked up with that. So it's a touchy subject.
It's a very valid point. And those topics were discussed of like, what do you do? And the general feeling that I got, and this is just my opinion, is, DJI is making a great product. And unfortunately, most American-based companies are really not up to par on building safe, reliable equipment right now. May that change in the future? Maybe, but right now it's just not there. And it's a concern. And there was talks about, things that you can do to try to protect your data, like turning off your data plan while you're flying and whatnot, and then just kind of there were some folks talking about you can actually get into the drone and open up the flight controller and then pop out the SD card and blank it out.
Oh, interesting.
So supposedly, I haven't done this, and this is just what I was told. There's a little micro SD card that actually stores basically like a black box that stores everything that, so when they pull it off of your DJI drone where they pull off the flight information, they're pulling off this SD card. So supposedly it's epoxied in. So you can epoxy it or remove the epoxy and then pop the SD card out. But you, again, have to crack open the flight controller to get at it. It's not something readily accessible.
Fascinating.
Probably will void your warranty too.
Yeah, probably. okay, so let's get back for a second. You said that this fire team had the M600. When we trained the Rancho Cucamonga team and when we trained the Anaheim Fire Department, the M600 was kind of too big and bulky to be able to get out and get up and available quickly. So my question to you is, seeing that M600, knowing that the M210 is on its way out, and again, on its way out, and knowing that a lot of fire departments are still using the Inspire 1, in your opinion, what do you think is the best vehicle for fire departments?
Well, it's an interesting question. It depends how much space you have, because you pointed out a very, very important thing that most engines don't have a whole lot of, and that's space. Now, York County, they had a whole trailer dedicated to this drone. I mean, they had a whole operation center. They had flat screens on the inside, the antennas on the roof, and they had their M600 docked to it. So, but not every department is going to be able to do that.
Not every department is going to be able to spend a quarter of $1 million.
Yeah, I think they said they had like 70, 80,000 or something like that wrapped up to a lot of money. Now the 200, you know, as I understand, the Matrice 200 is a little bit bigger than a 100, and it's still a pretty big aircraft. It's not as big as a 600, but it's still going to require a pretty hefty size case, even maybe slightly bigger than what like an Inspire 1 would have.
I think so too.
My go-to right now when I'm called out is I go to my Inspire 1 right now.
Yeah.
And the caveat is, unless the winds are too heavy for the Inspire 1, which, believe it or not, can be, and that 600 flies like a boss in heavy winds.
Yeah, no, it totally does.
I had like a 40-mile-hour – it had to be 40-mile-hour, I guess, because I had one of those little wind meter things, and it was showing like 35, 40, and I just took off. It hovered right there, and then I flew into the wind like it didn't even exist.
That's awesome.
It was beautiful.
That's awesome. So flexibility, portability are obviously a big deal for fire departments.
Yes, and maybe a little less for law enforcement because, you know, they might have more access into like a trunk of a vehicle. But if you ever take a look at the side compartments on an engine, they're not real deep. And that's always going to be kind of a concern. I did see this one company try to build a deployment system for the roof of a fire engine. So basically think of, you know, these doors just opening up from the top like this and the drone pops up. And it can take off right from the roof of the engine. I did see one prototyping it, but
the problem with most of these systems I'm seeing, even like the UPS system, the UPS trucks and most fire engines are made out of steel. Like people do not understand the problem therein. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, no. Actually, a lot of them are being built out of aluminum now.
Oh, they are.
The cabs.
Okay.
Yeah. So I know our truck from about 20 years ago, 1830, there's a lot of aluminum. I mean, it's steel frame, but most of the body is all aluminum. So aluminum is actually getting more and more common. And good. So is fiberglass, lighter materials.
Yeah, right? I think that's good. I know with UPS and what they're using, it's like, guys, we can't have ferromagnetic material when we're trying to get compass information and land, you know, anyway.
It just doesn't work.
It just doesn't. When we were training Anaheim, you brought up a good point, those side compartments, what they did is they had a mobile control unit as well with screens, and we had the remotes hooked up to them and radios and everything. And they actually dug out the side of the truck with the rear fender wells, dug them out, and had their new control and command center go into the fender wells so they could use that to put shovels and picks and stuff, which I had never seen a pickup bed like designed and built like that. But like you said, you know, most fire engines, most fire departments, most public safety guys, their biggest issue that I'm realizing is budgeting. Because even though right now the M200 or the M210 is out, well, what about in 2 years from now? Because realistically, that's when they're going to get their money to even be able to have a drone. So it's like, how do you price for that? Do you price for the 210? Do you price for an Inspire? What would you recommend?
I'd price the 210 because you go for the 210, you know you'll cover if you wanted to go 600 route, you could go 600, you could go Inspire 1 if you wanted to go Inspire 1 because you've covered it with the 210, right?
Yeah.
Because that's probably the most expensive option out there. So, and that's the best information that we have. I think one of the things that fire departments are going to have to realize, and I tell public safety agencies all the time when I talk to them, I know I'm helping tons of agencies in my area right now and within the Illinois area. And the key thing I tell them is like, once you get a drone, it's like having an 18-month-year-old indefinitely. You're going to constantly have to take care of it. And then not only do you have to take care of it, but you're going to have to keep budgeting for it. I mean, just once you buy it, you know, it's going to have the same, I guess you'd say, plagued issues that you have with like cell phones, smartphones. You know, after a while, it's going to get outdated. The company is going to stop supporting it. They're going to stop putting out apps for it. Then all of a sudden, when the latest, you know, tablet comes out and your stuff isn't compatible anymore, you can't fly the drone or you can't view it anymore. There's no longer an app for it anymore. Or your batteries are gone and where are you going to get the new batteries? Well, they don't make the batteries anymore. So you might find them, you might not. So I tell most agencies that expect about 5 years of life out of your drone, but then you're going to need a budget for another drone in 5 years. And it's just like having any other vehicle that you have on the department.
Do you think five years is too long? Because I'm noticing even with my batteries, I can normally not keep them more than a year, ever, even no matter how many cycles are on them.
Well, I mean, in all transparency, I mean, you use the living daylights out of your drone, right? and the public service, if we used it once a week, and most of the time will honestly be training, right? It's going to be 99-98% training, then 1-2% of actual callouts. So if we use it once a week and we practice with it, and you know, we'll probably be out there with for 40 minutes, so maybe about 2-3 batteries. And assuming that we have, you know, 8 batteries, you know, for a long haul type day, I think we'll be okay. One of the things that I've been trying to think about is like, what is the best practice of keeping batteries charged and ready to go? Because, you know, I picture, and I'm just waiting for this to happen one day, that there's going to be this police department out there. I don't know who, or a fire department out there. I don't know who it's going to be. They're going to have their Inspire 1. They're going to stick it in the cab for 6 months. And all of a sudden, something urgently is going to happen. They're going to whip it out, and they're going to
voltage
hit that
drop.
Battery button, and only one LED is going to show up.
Yeah.
And I'm like, ah, yeah. What do we do?
I think you bring up a really good point. In fact, in my consultation to Rancho Cucamonga in Anaheim, in fact, I'm actually finishing a document to really tie it all together. I say you guys should do a Friday fly day every week, not because you're just wanting to go out there and fly because you're a bunch of giddy little kids. Because we are, let's be honest.
Yes, we are.
But at the same time, you've got to cycle those batteries at least once every 7 days. So it's a great opportunity to train your fire department. It's a great opportunity to continue maintaining those batteries. And it's a great opportunity just to keep in the organization and cycle of maintenance, you know, overall. And I think that's so important. So are there any other things that you see really really just really important for a fire department to know? You know, one of the things is that we've talked about is the Matrice 200, and you love the M600 because it had dual, gimbals. Why is the M210 in your eyes so groundbreaking for search and rescue and fire department use and public safety as a whole?
I think it's going to offer more. Just, you know, you can have that thermal imaging camera, you can have that electro-optical camera on the same device. Really, the proof is going to be in the pudding for when we actually see it. How's that going to work? Is it going to be like a LightBridge 3 that's going to come out? Because like with LightBridge 2, you know, you have the audio video input, but it's not really that great. I mean, it's great for a first person view camera in the front of your drone, but it's not really that fantastic. So how's that really going to work? What is the control going to be like? Am I going to have multiple controllers again, each with a different interface? Can I have a single operator? Because that's another really big issue with public safety. You know, we're working on tighter budgets, which means we have, you know, smaller personnel. Some stations only have 2 people manning an engine at a time, even though it can seat sometimes 4, sometimes 6 people. There's only 2 on there. Now I got to take a fireman or a policeman away from that role of being to fly the UAS. And, you know, some COA, public COAs out there, say you have to have a VO2. So now I'm taking away 2 people that could be fighting the fire. And my fire chief has told me this flat out. You come up showing up with a drone, I'm going to tell you put that damn thing down and put on an air pack. And he's right, because they're understaffed. Yeah. Now, you know, just an example, not to diverge too much, but York County, what they do is they actually work not only with the fire, but the sheriff's department too. So when there's a fire, the sheriffs fly the drone. And when there's a law enforcement incident, the fire department flies the drone for law enforcement. So I think that's a really great model. So you're utilizing the resources most intelligently. So it's interesting. The fire department has more law enforcement experience with drones, and the police department has more fire experience with drones.
Yeah, and it's fascinating. In California, they were like that too. In fact, they were saying that oftentimes the police will never get a budget for drones just because of the public perception that the police are spying on people. And it's honestly kind of sad. And that's why I'm glad to have this show with you, because maybe more people will hear the education on why it's such a powerful technology for search and rescue. One thing you mentioned that I think is important for fire departments who are considering using drones is you talked a little bit about the public COA, and I know this is basic info for you, but I think it's really good for other people to hear. There's the public COA and there's 107, and recently the FAA website changed and said government officials can either use a COA or 107, and it used to strictly say COAs only. So I'm really happy that the government entities can operate under 107, but what are important things to know if government entities are operating under a COA or operating under 107?
Okay, so there's 2 different types of public COAs. There's what's called a jurisdictional, which is probably what Anaheim has because of Disneyland out there, because they need the special airspace privileges. And then there's a blanket COA, which was very similar to the 333 that we've all had. And the FAA, you know, you kind of pick on and you work with them.
Sorry.
And then, of course, and then you outside the cozy of Part 107. I'm a big advocate of Part 107 for probably 90% of departments out there. Only if you have really complex airspace, I think a public co-op and probably jurisdictional would be more warranted. So if you're close to an airport, some type of specialized airspace, like, you know, like an amusement park, something like that, then you need a co-op. But in reality, even if you do get a public co-op, you should still fly whenever you can under 107.
I agree
so,
100%.
Because and here's the reason. When you fly public COA, you self-certify. And from a legal standpoint, if you get a real snazzy lawyer that if something happened, God forbid, if you self-certify, you're basically kind of washing the FAA's hands from the whole thing. So the FAA says, well, they self-certified, so we have no obligation for their liability. So your exposure, I think, is much larger if you're using a public COA. Now, there's a definitely place for it, but it's much larger. Under 107, you're running under a framework. So being that framework, it could have been an FAA regulation that was not that made you do something that created an unsafe atmosphere. Or it could have been air traffic control that didn't do their job, maybe when they issued you your airspace authorization. So the liability doesn't solely sit on that public agency. With that said, you know, if you get a public COA, I mean, the very first thing you're going to need to go get is your night waiver. That's just like, just go get it right away.
Luckily, there's a video out for that.
You and Vic did a great job of creating a video out there for that. So, you know, any public safety agency watching this, go thumb through the rest of the podcast and take a look at that video.
Yeah, no, I think it's a good one. Thank you for that, Keenan.
Yeah, no problem. So the other thing is, and I actually learned this at the public safety conference, is the FAA is coming out with a new thing. Before, it used to be called an ECOA, which stands for Emergency COA. And basically what it was is I could make a phone call and be like, hey, I need to go fly by O'Hare International Airport because aircraft went down or there's a hazmat spill. I need to fly a drone. Can I get my authorization? You can basically do that over the phone. But you had to have a public COA. Now that
so you can't do an ECOA unless you have a public COA.
Well, that's back in the day.
Okay.
We have a whole new thing now, Paul. It's all brand new.
Hit me.
It's called a special government interest. Horrible name. I'm not a big fan of the name, but government interest.
SGI.
An SGI, yes. SGI. And with this SGI, it works the same way, but here's the key thing. You could have a public COA or you can be part 107.
Huh.
And get this, and this is the awesome part. If you are a civilian contractor and I am a fire department, and I say, hey, civilian contractor, can you fly for us? I, as a fire department, can sponsor their SGI.
Wow.
So, you know, I could, you know, if
this
I was
is really a fire department. This is really important because if there is ever an emergency search and rescue, if there is ever someone lost because they went skiing, this is so critical, being an operator, that you know about SGIs, because chances are, Keenan, if you know about it, I mean, you're on the tip of the iceberg when it comes to new information with public safety. And so happy that you're a part of the Drone U community. And guys, if you didn't
Thank
know,
you.
He is. But it also means that a lot of other people probably don't know about this. I mean,
yeah,
I've
this,
never.
This just came out. They gave us a super squirrel secret phone number to utilize, and it's either official now or it will be official sometime this month. But they said they basically had it 99.9% done, and now it's just the 0.1 to get the rubber stamp of approval on it, and they're going to go forward with it. But it's so great for public safety agencies to say, hey, I can now go ahead and go for those public drone operators, like, you know, like Air Bears, if I wanted to. They come in there with the 107. I have a TFR because a tornado just hit my community and there's a TFR in the airspace. I can now just go ahead and make a quick phone call, and within minutes, the goal is, I don't know if it's true, but the goal is within minutes I can get the authorization.
Minutes. Yeah it's well, government. But I call this SGI like the buddy phone call. You know what I mean? Because at the end of the day, that's really what it is. Hey, we don't have time for your red tape. Cut it. You know what I mean? So
yeah, that's basically what it comes down to. And I think the FAA is listening, but they have, you know, like anything else, they have their rules that they have to follow. And I do feel that they're trying to apply policies and more or less procedures what worked for manned aircraft, which didn't move on a dime from a technology standpoint, right? I mean, but if you take a look at drones, it's like every 6 months, it's like, I need a new toy, right? I mean, it's just constantly changing every 6 months. I mean, I just got my Inspire 2 a little bit ago, and, you know, I love my Matrice 600, and I like it just, you know, for the public safety. Like, I would never use it commercially, but for public safety, it's a heavy lifter. I could take a chainsaw, pick that chainsaw up with it, and move it to the other side of a bank.
It's funny you mentioned chainsaws, because if I saw John McBride's private personal feed correctly, you guys flew a chainsaw on a drone.
No, that was a bottle of wine.
Oh, I thought that was a chainsaw.
So the conference was at a winery.
Uh-huh.
And the people that owned it would say, well, it would be cool if you could take a drone and deliver a bottle of wine.
And so that's like, what.
Well, yeah, actually, that was the York County's M600 where it had the drop system. So you saw it fly all the way over there. They put it on the table, and then they just released the lanyard that was tied to it and flew the drone back. So it was kind of cool. But the FAA, I mean, it was – that conference was really serious. The FAA was there. We had Airbosses. So, I mean, it was the tightest airspace I've ever flown in.
Really?
And I did a demo for doing a mapping demo, actually. It was the demo that I actually did. And, you know, I had to, you know, get authorization, get approval. And even though it was someone's personal property, but because we had Airbosses and we had like two or three representatives from the FAA, you know, they wanted to make sure that we were being extremely safe. I mean, it was pretty much event free the whole day. I mean, it was kind of cool, but, we played it like if it was a real situation. So when there were every single drone we knew about, and they had technology there that could actually see all the drones in the air. I think it was actually reading the radio signals from the drones.
Really? Do you remember the name of that system by chance?
No, they wouldn't tell anybody.
Yes,
it was shocking. It was hush hush. Like, I don't know if it was top secret, but they wouldn't allow anybody near the van. That's for sure.
Really?
I know we had companies like FlyMotion was out there. Obviously, RMUS was out there, but FlyMotion was probably the other big one, and they had a lot of antennas on top of that van. A lot.
Interesting.
So it could have been out of there. I don't know.
Interesting. FlyMotion, checking it out now. Well, Keenan, you've provided such good information, man. I'm glad you could come on the show. Wow.
Thanks,
is there anything else that you think is really important? I mean, I know you're going to be coming to the fly-in. I know you're going to be doing some search and rescue stuff there. So if people want to come out and meet you and kind of work alongside
absolutely.
You, they can. But is there anything else that we should know about? I mean, you've got the ear right now of a lot of fire departments. What would you tell them?
Here's the biggest thing. You know, budgets are always a concern. And sometimes even trying to show value and trying to influence, like, you get it why the drone's important. But sometimes it's a little harder to convince a fire chief, convince, you know, your town council, your mayors. And in doing so, you know, take it in baby steps, crawl, walk, run. Start with SOGs and write those SOGs in such a way that, you know, especially if you're a small community, like, you know, 9,000-10,000 people, write it so that way you can work with both a civil operator or if you had the drone was within the department itself. Don't worry so much about getting the drone right away. Figure out how you're going to interact with a UAS, because it's going to be a tool that everybody's going to want to have. And right now there are probably more civil operators, obviously, than public safety. So get your SOGs, get your policies, get your procedures out there. Work on those first. And then you can worry about getting a grant. You can worry about how you're going to actually fund the drone. And then start with something simple. Get a Phantom. Get a Phantom 3. What, they're $500-$600 now or something like that? Like,
so
if I got a Phantom 3 Pro.
Yeah.
And start practicing that, because odds are, you know, you probably will accidentally clip a prop and crash a thing. It's going to happen. Because it's just part of the beast. But get good at it. You know, having a Phantom 2, getting one with prop guards, you know, it saved my butt once or twice when
you
I was first learning.
You are the prop guard king.
Hey, you know what? It's on the Phantom. It saved my butt a few times. I'm not gonna lie.
I mean,
when I was first learning to fly, if it didn't, I would have probably lost more Phantoms. I mean, I would have lost the Phantom that I had. So,
gotcha. And I think practicing with prop guards is important. I would just like to warn everyone: don't get comfortable with them, because they take so long to take on and take off, and honestly, they really affect the aerodynamics of the bird. So when you get more into sensitive flight, like, really be cognizant of that. It's not going
to
be.
Yeah, if you're trying to do like commercial film, you don't want prop guards on there, right?
No.
But if you're doing like some like still photography and like you have a bunch of trees around you type of thing.
It wouldn't hurt.
It's going to reduce your flight time for sure, and it does affect the dynamics. I mean, the bird does handle differently when you have it on there. So every tool has its place, right? So when you're training, use them. You got a first-time flyer, use them, because, you know, they may accidentally hit the wrong stick and try flying into the fence or into the wall of a building. And it's just better to have the prop guard than not.
Yeah, true. Very true. Very true. Well, but, I'm excited.
I think that's it. You know, that's my big thing, dude. It's policies and procedures. Figure out how you're going to work with drones in your public safety agency.
I think it's actually what I'm helping Rancho with right now as the follow-up to our training. But to all the fire departments out there, how can we find out more information about you, Keenan? Where would we go?
Yep. So myself and Dominic Whitmore, who's another guy in the department with me, we started a YouTube channel and we have a website. You can search the YouTube channel by searching for Saving Lives with Drones. Or you can just go to the website, which has all our videos on it, at www.savingliveswithdrones.org.
Awesome.
And, you know, it's a free resource. And basically, we're just – our niche is specifically around public safety, law enforcement, fire. If there are any general questions out there, there's a contact us form. Just fill a question. We'll do our best to get an answer and get it out there. And, you know – I mean, honestly, Paul, it's what you and Rob do is what kind of inspired Dominique and I to do what we're doing. So thank
you. Awesome. Hey, man, thank you for being a part of the community, because seriously, it's guys like you that keep us all together. And guys, if you're affiliated with a fire department, if you volunteer for a fire department, or if you work for a fire department, I would highly recommend that you check out Keenan's website. Highly recommend you check out the Drone U. And by the way, Keenan, we actually have our class coming up from that training with Rancho Cucamonga. So we're going to be putting out that video very soon so people can see kind of the teaser of the whole class with John's thermography stuff and, you know, basic operations, but also they can see the obstacle courses that we did with Rancho Cucamonga. And I think people will really get a lot of value out of that. So that'll be up soon for anyone who is interested in really continuing to research using drones in public safety. But Keenan, thank you so much for coming on the show, man. The information just so valuable.
Thank you so much.
Oh, I appreciate it.
All right, man. You take care.
You too, Keenan. Thank you very much. And guys, for everyone who's listening out there, if you want to hear more information from Keenan, seriously, check it out. It is worth it. It is totally worth it. And also, if you subscribe to our YouTube channel, you will see the new public safety course teaser come out very shortly. But on that bombshell, that's going to do it for us today. My name is Paul, and you're watching the Ask Drone U podcast.
We believe that videos, images, words, and sounds have the absolute power to inform, inspire, and entertain. We reject indecision, confusion, and vanity, for they work against the community. We are united under the virtues of safety and knowledge. We are a training community of learners and teachers who encourage and energize each other to achieve greatness. We are pilots, videographers, photographers, freelancers, business owners, enthusiasts, experts and apprentices. We are creators. We are the Drone U.